from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Yes, Ryan is not, deceased or anything else like that, which is always the joke that we start off with every time Ryan's not here. It's like, he's dead, ha ha ha. And you know what? One day that'll happen and it won't be funny.
It won't be funny.
Well, maybe
it'll be hilarious.
It will be hilarious. Everyone's going to have a big, giant laugh. And you know what? You should laugh at the face of death because otherwise it's too depressing.
Yeah. Well, if it's going to be the last thing you do, you might as well go out laughing, I would say.
Yeah, go out laughing.
Exactly.
You know, go out slaughtering.
I will laugh at pancreatic cancer.
I'm going to go out bombing. You know what? I don't think anybody should be going out with any INGs.
No.
You know? No. Too many INGs are bad. I don't want anyone doing anything other than just dying.
What
just
about
die.
Sleeping? Well, what was that? What was that saying there? It was one of those Jack Handy quotes. When I die, I want it to be in my sleep, like my uncle, not
like
screaming
the...
and yelling like the passengers of his car.
Yep, I know that was that's a classic one. So it's almost like one of those things that you wish you could say that you invented it.
I know,
because all of a sudden you're done. You did it.
You did
that one thing that everybody knows.
Yeah, but nope, you got to give props because everybody knows that it's not yours too.
Oh yeah,
you can't get away with that shit.
It's like I'm not foolish enough to think that I can get away with talking about foolish. You know what I realized? I realized yesterday on the podcast. We were originally talking on the. About the cat. Now, if you are not a patron, that's the bonus show that's available for patrons only. You need to go check it out because we had a pretty good one yesterday on Scientology. So if you love Scientology, guess what, bitch? You got to pay for it. Bam.
Well, that's Scientology. It fits. That's the theme of Scientology is you pay for the information. I think
right.
It's fitting.
I think it's only fitting that I hide
so.
It. Plus, and it has another advantage, too. You know, when you hide it behind the... podcast,
the wall
fewer,
of curiosity.
Yeah, the wall of curiosity. Fewer of the Scientologists will be able to hear the kind of things that you say because I don't want to get sued. So it's just smart thinking. But anyways, the story that I was originally supposed to talk about was Ryan's cat who did something. I forgot to mention because my rant was actually basically at the time was just that cats, tend to generally like me, or at least I think they try to fuck with me. And what he did was, here's basically the story of what happened the other day with the cat, and you should all be made aware that the cat is still alive, so that's an important, amendment to this story.
I
let him live.
And still be alive.
I left him live.
I left him to live.
I go downstairs about a couple of days ago, and I go to bed, and all of a sudden, when I'm lying down on my blanket, I touch something wet.
Oh, this is not going to end well.
I touched something wet. So at first I was like, shit. I remember the night previous I had eaten some cereal in bed because I couldn't fall asleep. And I thought, holy shit, did I spill cereal or something like that without knowing it? But it wouldn't explain why it's wet. And all of a sudden there's a distinct smell that starts emanating, And I realize, like, it's kind of like, when your lip's quivering? Like,
yeah.
Where you're like, I can't believe this is happening. You're like, well, motherfucking cat shit on my bed. Motherfucker. Shit on my bed.
Welcome to cats.
And the reason is because Ryan is gone on vacation, so he's not getting the kind of attention that he wants. I was wondering what all that meowing was about. I'm like, why is this cat meowing? And it's basically, it was him on my bed meowing, being like, come here. Come here.
I gotta show you something.
Come here. And I don't even know if it was, I want to show you something. It's more like, pay attention to me. Pay attention. And I was like, fuck you. Obviously, it's going to be like, oh, yeah? I'm going to shit on your bed, motherfucker. You are going to pay attention to me. Good or bad. One way or another. So I had to kind of suck it up, threw the blanket in the washer, tried to fall asleep despite mounting rage. So, for the next few podcasts, if you hear a cat meowing and you hear me yelling, that's just me kind of like taking out some of that frustration.
Fair enough.
Cat shits on my bed and...
That cat actually mauled me the last time I was here. I made the horrible mistake of petting
him. Don't pet him. He doesn't want to be pet. You know what he wants? He just wants to lie on top of you.
Yeah,
that's all he wants to do.
He's like
weird that
30
way.
Degree weather. That's 30 degrees Celsius.
It's like, do you want a 14-pound creature to heat up your crotch area? I don't think so. It's
no.
Like, if I want swamp crotch, then the cat can sit on this thing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, no.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the of atheist related stuff rather than all this cat hating. Otherwise, I'm sure that, you know, the female fans that do think that I'm cute were probably completely utterly repulsed by that. So let's move on.
Okay.
You know, because anytime you say anything bad about cats, the girls hate you.
Do they?
Most of them do. They think that there must be some horrible thing. It's like, all of a sudden, if you hate cats, you're going to hate kids or something. I'm like, they're not the same.
Cats aren't the same as kids.
They're really not the same.
You can't castrate your kids.
I'm like, I'll tell you what, if you think that your cats are like your kids, you are fucked up. I don't want to date you. I'm not dating you.
There you go.
Now, the one thing that I put up, and this is an article that really got popular. It wasn't anything that I tried to do. Like, you know, once in a while I try to promote articles. This one, I wasn't. I was just commenting on the fact that Kirk Cameron has released a 150th anniversary of the Theory of Evolution book. And
which he studied exhaustively, right?
Oh, well, he must have, because he decided to include a 50-page special introduction about evolution. And it includes passages about why Darwin doubted his own theory, how he was trying to use evolution to justify the Holocaust or other kind of, like,
wow,
genocidal tendencies, that he was a racist.
How Ben Steinian of him.
Oh, yeah. And they quoted some of his actual, there's this very famous quote where he talks about how natural selection could be applied to human beings.
I know exactly what you're talking
where
about.
He's talking about, like, you know, in nature the lowest of people wouldn't be, you know, bred and that kind of stuff. But the reason why Darwin mentions this is specifically because he's like, but we don't have to do that. We don't have to be like nature, cruel and fucking red tooth and claw.
Yeah.
We can move beyond it. And I think that that's the portion they always leave out. It's the most important portion, which shows you that not only was Darwin not a racist, I mean, like, at least not considered at the time what you would, you know, think of a racist. I mean, probably he had
tendencies.
You're probably like, well, the Negroid race is an interesting, you know, phenomenon. Like, that's how they felt. You know, they probably felt like, here's a creature that, you know, looks very human and it seems to be just as intelligent, but they are still different. I mean, like,
yeah,
I'm sure by then, if you've ever seen a guy that has a different skin color than you, you must have freaked the fuck out.
Mm.
You know, and despite that, you know, Darwin was, you know, he didn't think of them as any lesser.
Right, just as an interesting, not anomaly, but
like, I'm sure, like every Englishman, he probably felt saying, like, well, these are people that are savages, but they can be educated. That was the prevailing opinion at the time. You know, Britain's all like, we are the kings of the...
We owe it to the world to spread our knowledge.
Well, look, they had the largest empire of any civilization that ever existed. So, you know, they can tip their hats and say, look at us now.
The shit.
You know, we're pretty much a result, you know, like, we're part of the colonies, man.
And I have the teeth to prove it.
Snizzap. Now, I wanted to talk... I wanted to talk about Kirk Cameron in particular, and this is for people who may not know who he is.
When was the last time we slammed him? Because it seemed like so long ago we were talking about Left Behind and
The Master. Kirk Cameron, when we try to watch... Okay, for anybody that doesn't know, Kirk Cameron was on...
Growing Pains?
Growing Pains. Yeah, he was Mike Seaver in Growing Pains. And
Teen Heartthrob.
Oh, he was a teen heartthrob, yeah, at the time. And when he was about 18, he converted to Christianity. I mean, there's converting to Christianity, and then there's going, like, the deep
crazy, end. Ruining your TV show, converting to Christianity.
Yeah, that was Kirk Cameron, who basically felt that after his conversion, he needed to suddenly have, I guess, not directorial control, but at least some degree of control over the content of the show.
Right. Well, he was
pitting his character against. He said, like, well, I don't think those are good things.
I don't think. Well, wasn't one of the characters in the show like a teenage or an un? Oh, it was like teen pregnancy or like a date, marry or sex out of wedlock or something. He like refused to do it, and they had to change the entire plot line. And one of the characters of the cast like was either fired or chased off the show by him, kind of thing. Like, if you wiki it, you'll find the whole sort of affair.
Well, it depends, because sometimes they do suppress that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think Kirk Cameron probably very closely monitors his own Wikipedia page. What basically happened is that he went over really to the deep end. I mean, like, the only projects that he works on are Christian projects. including, I think, his latest movie is, like, Fireproof or something
like that.
And in that movie, I mean, he even refused to kiss any woman that wasn't his real wife. I mean, like, he has a rule about that. You know?
Yeah.
So, you think you can go far as an actor when you can't kiss anyone other than your wife? I'm like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Can't be a leading man in anything.
Nope. Not unless your wife is just as good an actress, and I doubt it.
Well, you know, I think it's weird, too, that he kept on, like, every show or movie that he's been in, if he's had a wife, it's been her. And I'm like, that's getting kind of tired here, you know? Like, there are certain TV couples I like the Mad About You couple, I guess, I kind of like.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I can see that.
But, I mean, I don't want to see them always married
in
every
other
movies.
I wouldn't want to see Helen Hunt in Aliens.
Yeah, exactly. That would have just... Well, I don't think anybody wanted to see Paul Reiser in Alien in the first place, but...
He played it. He was a delightful asshole in that movie.
He got his.
Yes, he did. Yes, he
and
did.
I think that we're all happy that Paul Reiser got his.
Yes.
But my point is basically that Kirk Cameron, he is part of an organization called the Way of the Master. And what the Way of the Master is that they're basically an organization that is very hardcore evangelical organization that wants to convert people over to Christianity. And they have a very specific mandate about how to accomplish this. And the best way that I can describe it is using their own words, where they suggest that people bypass the intellect, or what they call the area of doubt.
Reason, doubt.
Reason, logic, whatever. I think they even admit that this is that same reason. They're like, you need to speak to people's emotions.
Yeah.
And that's how you're sort of like going to get through them. And
just
I'm like,
sneak
that's...
past the brain.
Exactly. Into the gut. Yeah. You need to get into that gut.
That's where the soul is.
And then you tell people that those gut feelings that they have is God talking with you, and you have yourself a perfect formula.
God talks to me a lot when I have, like, beans and curd.
Beans.
And nasty shit.
Do you even eat beans?
Only if I get, like, there's a $5 breakfast special at this restaurant that I go to, and they give them to me. And sometimes if I finish my orange juice too fast, I'll have the beans because there's liquid in it because their toast is dry.
So the answer, really, to your, really, the answer to your, not really. I mean, you don't go out of your way to eat beans, so don't bring that up. Everyone's going to know.
Look,
you're a fucking faker.
I was just trying to say that indigestion, does not equal God. You just killed it.
I did.
You see what he does?
Nailed it. Nailed it.
This guy has no values, and he can't find a cat to kill, so he'll just kill my joke.
Well, I can find one. I'm just not allowed to. I was watching some of the Way of the Master videos because I try to pay close attention to what techniques they use. Because these are recruiting methods that they've learned from. And one of the really interesting things that they talk about is they take a very different approach to their evangelizing than others do. And they talk about specifically what evangelicals do, like they make people make affirmations, and they're supposed to make it like have all these statements and that kind of stuff, and you sign it, and it's all very official because it's a way for them to keep track of how many people get converted and saved and that kind of stuff. And they were like, did you know that 8 out of 10 people who sign in on this, they don't have any follow up, so we're losing all these people. Which is an interesting way of seeing it. I'm like, I'll tell you what. I actually think the reason that 8 out of 10 people might be eventually kind of not following through is because they were just signing it to be polite, dude.
or to just stop you from yelling at them.
Yeah.
Have you heard Ray Comfort, like, proselytizing on his soapbox?
I have.
He's such an, like, he seems like such a pleasant man, but then he starts yelling about how you're a sinner, and you're just like, dude.
Calling you, it's like, have you ever lied? Then you're a liar.
Have you ever stolen a pen from the office? God doesn't grade on a curve. You're going to hell.
Well, here's the interesting thing, actually. From all of my research and from watching all of it, I can say with certainty that there is one fail-proof method that they use to convert. And basically, they try to use, there are specific Bible passages. Let's say a guy comes over to Jesus, and he's like, Jesus, I want to go into heaven. What should I do? Now, they're like, okay, if you were asking today's evangelical, the evangelical will try to be your friend, would be like, well, let me show you a way, and, like, this is all about love, and blah, blah, blah. This is the typical evangelical technique. And the Way of the Master says this is wrong. This is not what Jesus would do. He says Jesus would have told you what you were doing that was already wrong. He would have told you that you were committing a crime of some kind and that you needed to...
Relax.
to absolve yourself of these crimes. And one of the examples that they use, interestingly enough, is they say, imagine that you have a $25,000 speeding ticket, but someone paid it for you. Then you wouldn't think that that mattered, and you think that'd be crazy. But they're like, well, imagine now you were actually speeding, and you were driving dangerously, but someone paid the fine for you. Well, if you understood that you had done something wrong, then you can start sort of like seeing that there is a person who is going to absolve you from that wrong. It's that whole, remember how we mentioned it last time? It's the whole, you create a need, saying like, you are a sinner, you are a bad person. You're like, shit, I am? And they're like,
what
but don't worry. Don't worry. All you have to do is surrender everything to this one guy called Jesus. Surrender. Absolutely surrender. And you'll find bliss.
Well,
and I'm like, God damn, you know, like that is what the message is. Oh, that's fucking scary, dude. Surrender to the master.
Well, come on, way of the master.
Well, yeah, they don't hide it. Oh, I mean, like, look, you ever see those fucking statues that say Lord of Lord, King of Kings? I mean, it is a very hierarchical fucking way of viewing the universe. They're like, there is one God, and he is the mighty Lord. Like, this is how they feel. This is how they think.
There's that angle as well, and there's also the whole angle of you completely, like, skirting responsibility. I think, well, I'm sure you've heard it, given, like, the Christopher Hitchens fan we have here, but remember his whole comment on it. It's like, even if I do pay your parking ticket, that doesn't absolve you of what you did. That doesn't make you, it doesn't make it as though you never did that. It doesn't, you know what I mean? It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card if someone helps you out anyway. Like, what kind of responsibility are you taking when you're saying, I can do anything I want, I can fuck up as much as I want, but as long as I believe, then someone's going to take that responsibility away from me.
Well, here's the way that I can describe Christianity, probably the quickest way, at least this type of Christianity, is I think that they're really not interested in, they're not really, how to describe it, they're more interested in soul management is the best thing I could say. They're like, well, at any moment, you could fucking die, so you need to have your soul shit in order. And it's really is. I mean, it's management.
It, yeah.
It's management. So they're like, well, we offer you a way to manage. And part of their management that you have to do is you have to go out and proselytize yourself. You need to save other people. And this is what gets annoying. This is what makes them do things like fucking reprint The Origin of Species. Because now they feel that they have a duty. And to some degree, I can kind of appreciate someone who's like, I have a code and I'm going to follow it. But I'm like, that code makes you do things like write 50 pages indicting the very book that you haven't read. I'm like,
well, that's
you can
thing.
Put 50 pages saying none of this stuff is real, but dude, you have to take, you know, like the book itself on its own merit. Who gives a shit what you write at the beginning? It's like, so these are your opinions, and obviously you didn't read one page of this, did you?
Yeah, well, anybody who writes a preface to a book, it's automatic that they're going to be looked at as an authority on the subject anyway. That's the problem. It's like, you could have any, he could write, and like, he doesn't have to do research. As long as his name, like, as long as he's doing the foreword, it's like, oh, well, this is a guy who knows it, you know, oh, he's...
He must have, because he put it
they
in
wouldn't,
front.
They wouldn't have let him write a foreword to this book if he didn't know his stuff. You know, you always get a professional to, you know, someone in the field to write about it. So here we go. Although it's a weird, like, it's like an extended version of that, you know where they were protesting in, where was it? The last, I think it was in 98, the last evolution trial there. Not Scopes, but
the Dover
Pennsylvania.
One?
Yeah, I
the
think
Dover
it was
trial?
Dover, the Dover trial.
That was in 2000, dude.
Was it 2000?
I think it's like, I don't know, 2000.
I don't remember.
Didn't you read a book?
Yes.
Called 40 Days and 40 Nights?
Yes.
It's based entirely on that.
It was.
You read that book?
I read that book.
But you don't know what year it was.
I don't remember the dates. I'm bad with names and dates, Jacob. Why do you think I call everybody hey you and sir?
I call everyone hey you as well.
So there you go. Anyway.
You're forgiven. You're forgiven.
I'm forgiven. You've absolved me.
For not doing your research.
For having done my research 3 years ago when I read the book and not remembering the date.
Well, I'm sure actually if you go back on some of the older episodes of Good Atheist, you could actually probably find it. Except for if you're trying to find anything from episode 14 down, I've lost these, so they're... Unless, if you've got a fan out there who has those, I'd greatly appreciate those because I don't actually have them on my server. So people
really?
Who try to go back and listen to them, I lost it when I did the server transfer. I thought I had them, but I did not. They're gone. They're lost in the ether.
Oh, that's tragic.
So, I mean, there's bound to be, hopefully, somebody out there who has some. So if you do, send me an email, jacobfortin@gmail.com. I'd appreciate it, actually.
Yeah,
I think some of the fans would appreciate it. I've been getting emails asking me, like, hey, where are those episodes? I want to listen to them. You're like, sorry.
They're gone.
They
were raptured.
I'm like, we are not a very professional organization. We're a very amateurish organization. At least at the beginning, too.
Yeah.
You don't think that it's going to have any. You don't have any foresight. You're like, record whatever.
Yeah.
Put it up, whatever.
I remember, didn't we record one at work once?
We did that many times.
Yeah. Remember, like, a couple times I was helping with the podcast. Or Ryan would pop by after the shift and be like, okay, get out of the warehouse. We're recording a podcast. You're having Audacity installed on a work computer.
That's right. That's right.
I remember
that.
I did it on company time. Yeah. Stick it to the man. So anyways, yes, back to Kirk Cameron and his Darwin book.
Well, you know, most people probably think that, well, I had a number of individuals comment saying, like, can't we do anything? What about the family of Darwin? I'm like, look, it's public domain.
Yeah.
So there ain't nothing you can do. You can release your own one with a 50-page intro saying Kirk Cameron is a retard if you want. You can really put
can
any
you
intro
that
you
that
want.
Can you be libel?
No, not if you're making a personal attack, if you call him a cocksucker or a jackass. You're allowed to do that. It's not libel. If you call him a fraud, a thief and that kind of stuff, yeah, he can sue you.
Okay,
but not
if you
call
him
an
asshole. Okay. I learned from the first episode of Bullshit.
He's a piece of shit.
You can do that.
You can say, hey, you piece of shit. And you know what? Even if the person sues you, you have the court of public opinions, which is worth about $0, but still.
Whose point did you just prove? Oh, yeah, I just wanted to get back to my point. His 50-page intro is a lot like that little stamp that they put on the science books that says, you know, this is just a theory and it's not real.
Well, you know, I think that we should print out Bibles that just say, basically, this is a work of fiction and it should not be read by children.
Any similarities to any person's living or dead or revived are purely coincidental.
Yeah, I'm like, that would be very insulting to them, I'm sure. I'm like, having a guy who does not believe in evolution write a foreword for The Origin of Species is very insulting indeed.
Yeah.
Anyone who picks up this book, any school that does, like, you are supporting
fraud,
retarded shit, all right?
Yeah.
Like, do you want to be a laughing stock? I mean, what do you think the long-term consequences of being, you know, intelligent designers is going to be? You think that we're going to look back 50 years in that and say, wow, there really was a revolution in science at that point? You're like, oh, my God.
Thank God for the hindrance of stem cell research.
It's like, we would have had cures earlier.
We could have cured cancer.
They don't want that.
Well,
I don't want
it. Less souls for Jesus.
Now, okay, let's move on to the next subject, because this is one that we disagree on, and actually a lot of people disagree with me on this one, and so
we're going to
this one out.
You claim you have an ace in the hole, so I want to hear this.
The story is basically that in France, they are thinking about outlawing the burqa, and there's a lot of people in Britain that are saying the same thing. And I wrote that basically I actually surprisingly supported banning the burqa. And now that's a pretty big statement, because I don't believe in banning a lot of things.
Also, just if I could, you also mentioned in that entry, unless I misread it, that people who don't like that idea are free to find another country to go to.
Well, there are many countries that have those traditions. And I'm like, if that's your culture to tradition, then there's nothing I can do about it. But there's a very specific reason why I have such a strong stance against burqas.
Go on.
And it actually has to do with the fact that one of the best barometers you can have in a society about how peaceful it is, how lawful it is, actually has to do with the role of women in society. Like, if you look at our society now, the reasons why we have less crime, why we have, like, fewer murders, why we're just more peaceful in general, is literally because women have such, like, have a prominent place in politics, both in voting and also, unfortunately, less predominantly, but still a presence in government. It's mostly guys that kill, okay? It's mostly men that steal. It's mostly men that commit crime. Like, the percentage of women that commit crime is a lot lower than men. And in any culture where you don't allow women to have the same rights, where women are, sort of second-class citizens and where men make all the decisions, you're going to, unsurprisingly, find that these places have, you know, far more human rights abuses, a lot more of, you know, sort of social, you know, like a lack of social cohesion, that kind of stuff. And you're, and look at theocracies as a perfect example of that. You know, like, these are not places that you think are peaceful. You know, they may say, like, oh, our religious books and our cultural traditions are better than sort of like these modern ones. But that's really not true. I mean, we look at today's crime rates and statistics. They're the lowest they have been in 800 years. Okay? And they keep going down the more that people are sort of like well integrated in society. For me, the burqa represents a unique problem in our ability to integrate women into society properly. It's a unique problem because we think, for instance, that the burqa is a religious symbol. It is not. It's a cultural symbol that is sort of like part of sort of the Saudi Arabia tradition and not really a part of the Muslim tradition at all. It is not. Like, there is passages in the Quran that suggest that women should dress, you know, modestly, but that is it. The rest are just basically mullahs that have decided that these are how women should dress. And the burqa themselves represent a unique way for a very conservative aspect of society to isolate the female population and to basically not take part in society. They're like, you will wear this veil and you will therefore not be able to interact with people on the same level. You won't have the same participation in society. And look, like, you could talk all day saying this is going to be a slippery slope and that kind of stuff. And, you know, sometimes these kinds of laws do end up being slippery slope. But we can't beat around the bush that this tradition itself is interfering with our, you know, like, the ability for the Muslim community to properly integrate. If they do not want to integrate, if they want to have these types of rules, if they want Sharia law, like, the best suggestion is move to a place that has Sharia law. Like, it's not welcome in Western countries. We don't allow Sharia law. We also don't allow lots of different types of voodoo ceremonies or other religious ceremonies that are found to either be inhumane, you know, violent or unsanitary. And we put bans on them because we're like, we can't have these in society. Even if they're religious traditions, they're not enough. Or even cultural traditions, they're just too much. Like, a society has to say enough. And that's what I feel. I feel like that about the burqa, basically.
Okay.
That's my point.
That's your point?
That's my point. That's my ace in the hole.
Oh, that was your ace in the hole.
That was my ace in the hole. I want to know.
Right.
Like, because I know basically what most people's objections are, but I want to know what
your objections are. Well, basically, I have two sort of objections to it. The first one is your spin on what the burqa represents, while that may be, like, accurate to some degree, like, because I didn't study up on it. I'm just going on. But generally speaking, it might not be that might not represent to some women oppression. It may not.
Oh, I'm sure it doesn't for a segment of them.
So to some women who don't feel oppressed, who wear it to celebrate tradition and what have you, stripping that away does seem to me it seems like it's very harmless for them to wear it.
I know it does, and here's my secret ace in the hole. Oh, and I'm gonna use as an example female circumcision, because it's the best example that I can give.
Okay.
Now, female circumcision, say, in Britain is illegal. You can't do it. And who do you think performs the most amount of female circumcisions? Other women. It's not done by men.
Okay.
In most countries, female circumcision is done by other women. And it's the problem is this, that you could say, all right, 10, 20, maybe even 30% of women who wear burqas support burqas and they believe that this is important to their tradition and so on and so forth. But the problem is that the remainder, are people that don't have the choice. Once you allow the burqa, you take away choice because it's part of a cultural tradition that removes choice.
But if you take away the burqa, you're taking away choice as well to that 30%.
Right, okay, but here's the thing. I mean, like, there's going to be a segment of the population that says, well, these women are not going to be able to integrate themselves because now they're not allowed to wear the burqa, which means they can't leave the house. And I'm like, the problem is still the same. The burqa is there or the burqa is not there. The real problem is the fact that these individuals are not allowing the female population to integrate
properly. Isn't it possible to say that should you allow the population to continue to wear the burqa, which as far as to some it might just be just clothes they want to wear, you know, like if you forbid people from wearing that, I mean, if someone is to integrate into society, doesn't it stand to reason, at least to some degree, that they would eventually adopt some of the values and they'd realize on their own, hey, I don't have to wear this, I don't have to be oppressed, and then they could remove it themselves. If you impose it, it's going to look almost as if you're like, okay, you can integrate, but you have to play by this rule, and this rule is you have to abandon that tradition that you know, to some is really friggin' important. I personally, I'm not the biggest fan of it. I think it's not, I don't know, it's just, from an aesthetic point, I don't think they look very good, but
okay, well, let me make another example here,
sure.
Because I think this will help. Imagine that the burqa is not really the tradition. The tradition is that women are not allowed to leave their homes.
Okay.
They're essentially, say, prisoners.
Okay.
Now, you could say, well, that's an important part of the tradition, and 10 or 30% of these women want to stay at home, and they should be able to do so, and so on and so forth. But the problem is that essentially the tradition itself is meant to do one thing and one thing alone. It is meant to isolate women away and to make them to be essentially second-class citizens and unable to interact with other human beings on an equal level. And the problem now is that you cannot, like, as much as we think that, well, you can have, like, societies integrate well and so on and so forth, there are certain examples where if certain cultural traditions are allowed to continue, the integration will be seriously undermined. And part of that is that, say, in Britain, if you look at what is the integration of the Muslim population in Britain, studies have shown that, for instance, 0% of the British Muslim population thinks that homosexuality is okay. 0%.
All right.
That demonstrates a huge...
But that's not the burqa's fault.
Well, listen. I'm the burqa is part of the same tradition that isolates the Islamic community in Britain.
Right.
Because they use it as a way of saying, well, okay, like, we don't want women to act and behave in a way that's similar to other Western women. And that is exactly what the burqa allows them to do. And I'm saying when you have integration, there's a certain degree of compliance that has to be met. And a person can say, you know, should I be allowed to bring all my traditions? And the truth is we don't allow all traditions.
No.
And this is one particular tradition that has such a huge impact on women that to suddenly say that because there's a certain segment of the population that might say, well, now that I can't wear it in public, I'm, you know, sort of like being oppressed. But the reality is that the device itself, the clothing itself, is already oppressive. It is already its intent. And I know there's plenty of people that are say it's not. But you'll find again that these are not the majority of Muslims in the world that, you know, because the majority of Muslims do not wear burqas. This is a tradition that is in Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia alone mostly, except for in other more radical Islamic countries. When women wear burqa, there is other things that happen around the same time. It's a chain of events. Like, here's another example. Let's pretend you walk into a park, and the park has graffiti on the wall.
Sure.
That will have a profound impact on how other people treat property around it.
All right.
It's called the broken window effect. That essentially, if you're walking down the road and you see a building that has windows broken and that kind of stuff, you are less likely to sort of, like, you know, throw your trash in the garbage or that kind of stuff. You may also actually act and do vandalism, actually, just because there is no consequence to your actions. It leads to a certain mode of behavior. Well, the burqa is the same way. It leads to a certain mode of behavior in the population where they enforce its wear.
But you're from banning the burqa, and I think it's going to be a stalemate. But enforcing the ban on just the burqa, isn't that more just? I mean, if we're talking about just the burqa as an article of clothing or as something that someone wants to wear, forbidding them from wearing it still doesn't seem fair. Now, if we're talking about people who are being held hostages in their houses and that's part of a tradition, well, that's a harmful tradition. But just wearing the burqa, even if it's part of it, you would just be treating a symptom and you wouldn't be treating the actual cause of it at the same time.
Yeah, but we treat symptoms all the time in order to be able to give the patient sort of better life. AIDS patients, you have to treat the symptoms.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea is that you need to, like, when you get rid of it, you would, and I'm not saying this sort of like, you know, sort of like as just a matter of fact thing. Look at in France, where they do have more serious rules against certain traditions, the Muslim population is better integrated than when, say, in Britain, where they're a lot more lax. And you're kind of like wondering, well, that seems oppressive and we really shouldn't do that. And you're right. It shouldn't be necessary. But unfortunately, we have to be pragmatic about this. And it makes things unfair. It makes us do things that we're uncomfortable with. But when it comes to the social impact of the burqa, like, do not underestimate the fucking danger it presents, particularly to women. Like, there's a reason why, say, every year in Great Britain, 500 women are circumcised. And there's nothing the police can do about it because these communities are so closed off. There is no integration. And part of that is in the traditions that they maintain that allows them to be isolated. And I'm like, these are the kinds of traditions that we have to get rid of. Like, I would love it if it could just be sort of through an educational campaign and what have you. But I'm like, they don't even educate their own women. Do you think there's going to be an education campaign for these people? No! They've already taken the position that these women are not supposed to be educated. Education is not the key. It's like, I'm sorry, we're just going to have to be dicks right now. And, you know, I hate to be the dick, but you have to. You fucking have no choice. They don't play by your rules. They really don't. It's like, we can't be Mr. Nice Guy about everything, and the burqa is definitely not one of those things. You look at any country that has the burqa, and the rate of, you know, sort of like female abuse, the rape, all these kinds of things, they're scary. These are statistics that would make you want to cry. And it's just because when you create, a repressive device that creates a second-class citizen in any country, don't be surprised when that second-class citizen is a fucking, you know, like, is in trouble, you know, if they're being shit on. And I'm saying that we can't allow that. We cannot allow that. It's just, I know, it sucks. I hate it. I wish it wasn't true. I still struggle with it, but at the end of the day, the pragmatic response is that if we continue this to happen, they will not be integrated. I can guarantee you that. They will not integrate. And you will have, generation after generation of uneducated women that live in segregated societies within sort of, these communities. You're just going to have sort of like these completely and utterly isolated communities, and that's it. And they will not integrate. The burqa is the symbol of their refusal to integrate.
Okay.
There is no clearer symbol of the refusal to integrate than the burqa. None. Like, none. It's like, it's not even, like I said, it's not even a Muslim tradition. It's a fucking...
Right. It's a Saudi, right?
Yeah. It's a Saudi tradition.
Okay.
Agree to disagree?
Yeah.
Don't like it, but, you know, you're a softy.
I'm a big softy. I want everyone to be happy.
Yeah. Everybody should be allowed to do what they want and that kind of stuff. And you know, to some degree, I've always agreed with that. But then on the other side, I know that everybody to do
whatever they want. just as my final talking point on it, I don't think that everybody should be allowed to do whatever they want if it's going to, you know, harm others, things like that. But
I don't think the burqa causes harm.
I think that a ban on the if you ban people from being able to wear the burqa, it's going to have a severe backlash and it may not have the desired effect.
I think there would be a backlash, but I think that these are the kind of backlash and these are the kind of things that we need to talk about. If the Muslim community comes strong in that saying that we should not be banning this, like, we need to have a serious conversation about what the burqa means. I mean, in the very least. Like, I'm talking about, let's floor this. Let's have a fucking conversation about this, because if everybody wants to keep that as a dirty little secret, then it's really not going to be addressed. We need to address this thing. You know, and the reason that I had commented on it was actually an article from a Muslim woman in The Guardian, or Times Online, I think. I forget which one. Who was saying that she supported the ban. Like, she is aware of its influence and its effect on women in the Muslim community, and she's like, this is a lot more dangerous than it is. It's not an issue. It's just sort of like, oh, I should be allowed to wear this. I'm like, wearing it has profound consequences on how people are treated and the opportunities that they have in those countries to both integrate themselves and to be citizens of, you know, with equal merit. And I'm like, that's what I'm talking about. These are the things that I want people to talk about. And it's not just a simple, well, we can't allow this. It's a slippery slope. I'm like, let's have a real doc conversation about it first. Okay. And then we'll see what happens. So that's my compromise.
There we go. Fair enough.
All right. With that, we're going to wrap it up. We'll catch everybody on Tuesday. Ryan's going to be coming back. So I don't need you anymore.
You won't need me and my dirty talking too far from the mic habits.
Well, I hope. Hopefully, this time. I mean, you look like you were
considering
give
I was,
my microphone a blowjob. So
that's true. But this damn visor's in the way.
It's called a pop filter. It's not a visor.
A pop filter.
Yeah, that's right. It filters out sort of like
the popping
wind
like,
and
oh yeah, oh
that kind of stuff.
Learn something new every day.
That's why it's seen through, that kind of stuff. So it just goes and go pop pop.
Oh, you know? Okay.
It's usually for the P sound actually. That oh, unsurprisingly, yeah? It's just the way. Apparently, P releases a lot of condensed pressure saying, and I gotta stop saying. Like,
yeah, sorry.
P and condensed pressures. No. I'm not going to end that sentence. All right, with that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Jeffrey Jones.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.
Cheers.